This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Hear an informed, intelligent and provocative discussion of issues every week as seen through the lens of sustainability. It is brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. It is hosted by Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher, and joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene. Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio, broadcast every week on Otago Access Radio, and podcast on sustainablelens.org and on oar.org.nz.
Welcome to Sustainable Lens Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher, who's not here tonight, and me, Samuel Mann. I'm joined by Daniel Kinney from the Highlands Organic Agriculture Cooperative in Papua New Guinea. Welcome.
Thank you.
You're touring the country talking about fair trade.
That's exactly right, yeah. I've been to Auckland and Wellington, I'm in Dunedin.
So, let's start with you first before we get on to the HOAC. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Papua New Guinea, in Eastern Highlands Province, in a district called Okapa District.
And what sort of life is it there?
Oh, it's a rural kind of life. We live in the rural areas where there's no electricity or water supply, all that. We sustain ourselves from subsistence agriculture.
Were you a farmer?
That's right.
Did you always growing up to be a farmer? Was that the thing you were going to do?
Yeah, I mean, like, I grew up back in the village, so there's nothing much I could do. There's no option. I have to be a farmer to sustain myself.
And what sort of farm?
That's two kinds of farm. One is for commercial, that's a coffee garden, and food crop like sweet potato and greens and, you know, yam and taro for our daily living.
And the commercial, is that for local consumption or for export?
I think in our case, coffee will be for exports.
What's the history of growing coffee in that area? Is it a coffee been grown there for a long time?
No, coffee was introduced by the missionaries who came in the early, you know, 1900s. Before the Second World War, maybe after the Second World War, I'm not pretty sure, somewhere around there. But it was introduced by the missionaries. And then the DPI took the seed from them, and they saw that coffee was really doing really well in our area. So, yeah, we started doing the coffee plantations and coffee farm.
Papua New Guinea is heavily rural, isn't it? It's, what's the percentage rural, do you know?
I think 87% of the total population would come from the rural areas in Papua New Guinea.
When we're talking about these rural areas, I don't suspect that they're the same as New Zealand rural areas. We wouldn't be expecting paved roads.
No, rural areas, you know, where there is no good road accessibility, there's no water supply, no electricity, all that.
You're busily being a coffee farmer.
That's right.
And selling your produce to, who do you sell your produce to before you set up this, the organization?
We were selling to, you know, every other, you know, exporters down the road. But when we got into fair trade, we had to sell to certified fair trade exporter, which is Coffee Connections in our case. So we sell all our fair trade coffee to Coffee Connections only.
Let's take a step back. I have no idea how one grows coffee. How do you grow coffee?
Well, we get the beans from the mature coffee trees, and we sow them into, you know, little polybags filled with, you know, earth and dirt and all those kind of things. And we allow it to germinate. And when we see the first brands coming up, we transplant them out to the field. And it takes like 3 years before it starts to go into production, first production. And then after that, you have cherries coming on every year. Up to like 25 years would be like a good lifespan for the coffee. And after that, it will be aging trees, so you won't get much production from it.
Forgive my ignorance. Despite being a botanist, I have no idea what a coffee tree looks like.
A coffee tree is a shrub. It doesn't grow any taller like a tree. It's a shrub. It grows up to like 3 to 4 meters. But every time we prune it and keep it short just for the convenience of the farmers to pick it and, you know, things like that.
We're used to seeing pictures of tea pickers being a very highly intensive process. There's lots of people out in the field picking. Is coffee similar?
Yes. I mean, like, you have to pick, you know, this individual cherries, so you need plenty of people to do all the picking. They are not big, you know. Fruits like apple, oranges, these are little tiny, you know, cherries. So you need plenty of people to get all the cherry together into the bag.
Is it a quite dry fruit to start with?
No, it's got this good red coat, you know, cover. And when you pick it, you know, you get sugary juice, you know, coming out of it. It can be sticky on your hand sometimes.
Okay. And what do you do with it next?
When we pick it, we take it to the, you know, our pulp station. We have our end pulpers there, so we pulp all the red skin out. And in there you see these dicotyledon seeds. And we put it in the fermentation box just to allow it to break down so that you this, what we call the micellars on the coffee, they break down and you can, it makes it easier for you to wash it and clean it up, and it will be really, you know, clean. So when you dry it, you have this sound parchment coffee beans. And then from there, you take it to the processing plant where you remove the husk. And then what comes out is a green bean, and that's the stage where we bag them and export it overseas. So the buyers overseas would be buying green beans, sorry, from us.
When you say green beans, are they green colored?
That's right. They look green. When you remove that yellow husk, the bean inside, you know, look more or less green, so we call it green bean. Yeah.
And what time does it turn black?
Oh, it's when you put it to the roaster.
Oh, okay.
You roast it and then it becomes black.
And is that process the same the world over?
Yeah, it's the same process.
And at what point in that process do the traditional corporations get involved, the international corporations? Do they buy, Nescafe or whoever it might be, they buy the green bean, do they? Or do they buy it earlier on?
They buy the green bean, yeah.
Yep. So that all that processing work, removing the husks and stuff, has to happen locally?
That's right, yeah. Yeah, most most cooperatives do not own a processing mill, so they would be selling their coffee in the form of parchment. That means it has this yellow husk, and then the exporters buy it and they process it. But for our case, we have our own processing mill, so we process and get rid of that husk, and then we supply only the green bean to the exporter.
So what started you thinking about setting up a cooperative?
Well, firstly, because we wanted to have a voice for the growers, because there were numerous growers and they were scattered. So we thought that if we get into group, we could have a voice, a legal voice for the, and then we could do things, you know, like get registered. And if we have to, you know, do things as a group, that would give us, you know, the advantage, you know, to get together as a group, and we can export our coffee. So if we have any issues, you know, we can address it as a group, so we got more weight. If we have to do it individually, then we might not have that kind of, you know, power in negotiation or that kind of things. Yeah.
And the idea of that more weight was to do what? What were you trying to improve in that process?
I think we were trying to improve the communication and the negotiation for price.
Presumably you thought it was too low, the price.
Yeah, I mean, like, the exporters were not coming clear on the kind of price they were receiving abroad, overseas. So we wanted to group ourselves so that we could get into some form of a system of trade. And there we found fair trade. And in this system, you know, we are given the opportunity where transparency is one of the main standards in the fair trade system. So in that way, you know, the exporter and the producer will know exactly how much that coffee would cost, so we can do a price breakdown. So everything is done transparently, so we don't feel have this kind of funny feeling like we've been cheated or something along the way.
It must be hard knowing how hard you're having to work to grow these things and doing all that processing to then see the price of a cup of coffee on the street.
That's right. It's really, you know, intensive work. A lot of work is put into trying to get the coffee into green bin. You know, you have to look after the coffee tree itself, then you have to pick it, you have to pulp it, you have to wash all these mucilage after fermentation away, you have to dry them, you have to bag them, you carry them, you walk, you know, distances, you sell it to the buyer, and then you have to transport it along this rough road, you know, rugged roads, all the way to the market point. So really, there's plenty of work, so you want to be rewarded, you know, properly, you know, at the end of the day.
What sort of price are we looking at for a kilo of that green bean?
It varies, you know, the market price, you know, fluctuates, it goes up and down. At one stage, it was at 10 kina would be like $5, and then right now it's like 7 kina, so like $3.50. $3.50. So it goes up and down within this range.
Yeah. And how many coffees would that make? How many drinks? Do you know how many drinks that would make?
Oh, no idea. But it would be plenty of coffee. Yeah.
You formed this cooperative. What's the structure of the cooperative?
The structure of the cooperative is like it's an inverted pyramid. You have the growers, which is the General Assembly, being the highest decision-making body. And everything is controlled by the producers. Then it comes down to the board members. And then you have the workers working for the... So really it's not the board that makes, you know, important decisions. It is the General Assembly that makes important decisions, and the board members, executive board's role will be to implement those decisions made by the General Assembly. So it's a different kind of system.
Yeah. What sorts of decisions is that General Assembly making?
They're making mostly on where they want to spend the premium money, the social premium we are receiving from our coffee, what kind of project, and how they want to, you know, work in the local communities, do awareness and training, what kind of training they require, what kind of impact projects they need in the community that they want to use the fair trade premium to accomplish, all these kind of things.
So where do you fit into that structure?
I fit into, after the General Assembly, then you have the board. And after the board, you have the management and the workers. So I fit after the General Assembly. So as a chairman, I only implement the decisions, you know, reached by the General Assembly, and that's how the fair trade system is designed, and that's how they want us to operate, and it's a good system.
So when this cooperative was established, how long ago was that?
In 2005.
So when it was established, you had this idea of grouping together to have more power, if you like.
That's right, yeah.
How did you find your way to the fair trade people?
Well, there was some awareness going on in our country. That there is a global, you know, market movement known as fair trade. And if you become a member of the fair trade system, you will be getting a minimum price for your produce. And then you will get a fair trade social premium, which you would use in community development projects. So we thought to ourselves, wow, that's a great idea. We might become a member, and we see how we that system will help us. So we joined the in 2005. But when we submitted our application to Germany office, it took us 18 months to wait before we get an inspector who came and did the initial inspection, and then finally got us into the system.
What was the nature of that application? What did you have to tell them?
Well, how many members you have and what are you producing, and are you happy to work with the fair trade standards, like environmental issues, no child labor, all this kind of thing.
Were any of those standards a problem?
No, it wasn't a problem with us. That's why we got certified. Otherwise, we wouldn't have got certification. But it doesn't mean that we were okay. We were still struggling to really fulfill, some of these standards. But then they got this allowance where they say you go into transition, and we give you this time, and after this time there is no excuse, you have to fulfill it to the fullest. So they have given us time, and during this process we have managed to learn and try to get there. So that's why we have been in the system for 10 years now.
What were the areas that were a challenge for you?
A big challenge for us, it's the the system trying to have the quorums at the meeting. Our constitution allow for 25%, so 25% of 2,600 farmers is quite a lot of people, and given the geography and the road and all the trying to get people together was a real difficult task for us. So like the fair trade system said, well, if you have not reached the quorum, you should not pass or make any decisions. And that was the toughest one we had. And if we cannot get, we couldn't get the quorum all the time, but whoever that came at that time, we managed to make decisions. And slowly we kind of understood the system, and now we are doing a delegate system. So instead of bringing 25% of the total members, now we have a system where we only bring the delegates from the cluster groups who have been democratically elected by the farmers to represent them at the General Assembly. So it is more or less a delegate General Assembly now. So that makes, Tins is here for us, and we don't have to go through this headache of trying to get everyone on the bed road to one particular, venue or spot for that meeting.
And what about the other areas? You mentioned child labour and environmental. So what are the environmental standards that it requires?
Well, in the environmental, they want us to do the, our farming in an environmentally, friendly way. So in the environmental standards, they have, the kind of chemicals we should use and the kind of chemical we are not supposed to use. But for us, we are doing organic, so that's not an issue. But they've helped us to identify, in a training that was provided by PSR, by Producer Support Relation team of Australia and New Zealand Fair Trade, they help us to identify risk areas in our community. So we do a risk assessment or an identification where is your water at risk or is your forest at risk? What about the soil fertility? You have a system in place, you want to improve the soil? And all these kind of things. So they really help us to understand our environment and how best we could manage it. Like you have a buffer, a zone where when you get closer to a river, a river system, do you have, you know, allowance that you keep your activity away from the river that's called buffer zone? So all this kind, you know, they help us to understand. Like, you know, previously we were just doing it, you know.
Do those things make sense to you? Are they things that you think when they started talking about that, does that appear as something which is like being imposed? What do these people want? That's a weird thing. Or are they things that, yeah, I can see the benefit of that?
Yeah, for us, we do not really get to see, you know, where they're coming from, because we got huge forest and we got, you know, there's so many trees. So if I cut this tree, you know, I still got plenty of trees, you know, remaining. If I do this, so our country is really young, so we have not really experienced that kind of impact, you know. Human activity can help on the environment. But through awareness and, you know, we see on television, see on the newspapers, and people are talking, telling us about, you know, if you are not really careful, all your forest will be gone, the wildlife will be gone, and in the future. So they are telling us about their experience. You see, this country, there was, you know, big rainforest. Now all that rainforest is gone. Due to they want to do cattle ranching or logging, all these kind of things. We are in our little nutshell. We need to really come out to understand. So when people from outside, you know, come and tell us such a thing, oh, then it opens our mind and say, oh, yeah, okay. If we are unconsciously doing these kind of things, but eventually we will end up where they have ended up. So it's good that they are reminding us so we can reconsider our ways of the way we, you know, we do things and how we interact with the environment. Yeah.
And is that across all of the 2,600 individual farms? They all have to have some sort of farm plan or a process that they've agreed to?
That's right. We have come up with an environmental plan. It took us a bit, you know, longer to come to the States because anybody couldn't do a good, you know, environment plan. Someone who's got the knowledge how to do it will do it. So we finally employed a person who's got a bit of environmental background there as an agriculturist as well. So that person now is putting together an environmental plan. So he will go out and do awareness in these little cluster groups. And, we will have, you know, a good, you know, environmental plan that the cooperative has, and we try to maintain it. It's not, we are not there, but we are getting there.
Yeah. When you walk around, does it seem better to you? Do you look at it and think, I like what they're doing. That's smart. Is it stuff that makes sense to you and looking at how it's now being managed? Does it seem like improvement?
Yeah, I mean, like, that's what we want to achieve. So when people understand and they accept what, you know, you require of them in terms of, you know, how to look after environment, it gives a sense of, you know, a satisfaction after all. We are, we come from the rural area, and the environment is very important to us for building materials, for medicinal, you know, plants we get from the environment, from the forest, the leaves and the bugs and all this stuff. Where there is no health services, we tend to our forest for, you know, medicinal, you know, herbs and all that. So, you know, our life is very connected, directly connected to the forest. So when environmental officer comes and, you know, say, have respect for the environment, well, we have it already. So it just, you know, it reinforces and gives us that sense from a broader sense that every one of us should be looking after the environment.
You said there were some other challenges. What other things have been challenges for you in joining this fair trade process?
I think these are the areas only we had an issue mm-hmm. over the last time, but the rest is just something that we need to learn and move on.
You don't sell directly to fair trade, do you? It's an accreditation system.
We don't sell our coffee to fair trade. We sell to fair trade, you know, exporter, which in turn it sells to a fair trade certified importer. So everyone that's involved in the market, you know, the supply chain of coffee are certified, and then they're audited.
Is it a different sort of relationship that you have with that exporter than you previously had?
That's right. We are more close. So everything that, you know, an exporter would want a farmer to do, especially like in terms of quality. And then volume of coffee supplied to the, because there is a shipment and there's a deadline. So, you know, now the exporter is working closely with us, so we kind of, you know, very close to them. We know what's happening. So, like, if the exporter say, okay, I have a shipment in June, can we get that container load of coffee organized? Okay, we'll go. And then we go into the back into the farmers and say, there's a shipment at the end of June, so let's get all the coffee together. So in that way, we are helping the exporter to meet that that market, you know, deadline on the other side. And also for us, we are selling coffee, so the farmers don't have to keep their coffee in their at home and wait for a market opportunity to open. So we understand that and we facilitate that. So every time, you know, there is coffee being sold, so there is no harvest that's sitting in the house waiting to be transported or waiting to be sold. The market is there, readily available, and we operate, transport and logistics. Yeah. So the cooperative owns and maintains its own transport fleet. So we move all the tractors and trailers and 4x4 vehicles, get all the coffee out to the exporter and the export. So every day in, like, we are busy.
Is it still a competitive relationship that you have with that exporter? You could deal with a different fair trade exporter, or is it one?
No, if there is, you know, a couple of fair trade exporter, if there is another fair trade exporter, then I think it's a question of price now. The exporter that is willing to put, you know, extra bit of money on top, I think it is the one that's going to get the market. if we look at it from a competitive sense. But for us, we are looking at it more from a relationship and trust and respect that we have built. So there could be someone in offering good price, but then we respect the other exporter because we've been working together and we have built that relationship and that trust. So we wouldn't, you know, back off, hide away and supply to another exporter. If we have to do it, it has to be done, you know, transparently. Like, I have a coffee here. You don't have a contract for that, and I have it sitting here, so there's a, you know, competitor up the road, he wants it, so I'm selling it to them.
So how do you know that you're getting the best price from that exporter? How do you know that that is truly fair?
What happens, we get the contract document from overseas. So there's an importer in, for instance, in New Zealand. He wants to buy coffee from us. He sends the contract document. So I want to buy one container load of this kind of coffee, A coffee or X coffee, and I'm willing to offer you this price. So this is the document that's transparently, you know, accessible to us. So the exporter gets it, and from there we work out a price breakdown. The exporter says, okay, I'm going to get this much from this price, and the rest belongs to you. So we operate in a transparent manner, and that's been made possible by the fair trade system.
So it's, you have things to do to be accredited at the farm or the cooperative level. The exporter has also been similarly accredited, and they've had some hoops to jump through in order to meet their accreditation.
That's right, yeah. So when the auditor comes every year, he audits us separately using small produce organization standards, and then he audits the exporter using the export standards. So it's different standards for different people in the supply chain, the small producer, the exporter, the importer, roaster, all that.
So who does the cooperative employ? What jobs are there that it does? You said that it's got an invite. There's you. No, you're not employed by it. You're the chairman.
I'm the chairman.
So who are your staff?
We have the management team.
Mm-hmm.
And the management team, you know, on a daily basis, they organize the logistics of, you know, transporting the coffee. They buy the coffee, they transport the coffee, they prepare the coffee, process the coffee, bag them, and work, you know, closely with the exporter. And they are paid to do that. Yeah.
And where does that money come from?
It comes from the business. Some part of the money comes from the fair trade premium, and we also operate our own business account, so it also comes from the business.
Okay. Yeah. So tell me about the price structure. So the exporter is paying a single price, or are they breaking it up into the price plus the premium?
I think it's the premium is separate from the price. Yeah. So they separate the premium first, and then later we do the price breakdown.
So the price would be essentially what you would get if you were to sell it on the open market, and then the premium on top of that, the social premium.
That's right, yeah.
And how do you distribute that social premium? Does that go out to the farmers, or do you do community projects with it?
That money is kept in a separate account called a premium account, and every year we have our annual general assembly, where all the members get it together, and in there we tell them that we've sold our fair trade coffee, and this is the kind of premium money we have in the account. So they come up with projects. Okay, well, let's spend some money on the water supply project, education project, health project, you know, these kind of things. So they're the ones that make the decision for that money. So we keep it in a separate bank account from the business account.
So let's go talk through some of those projects. Water quality. Rains a lot, doesn't it?
That's right, yeah.
So you've got lots of water.
We've got lots of water.
So what's the issue?
I think the issue here is clean drinking water, because we got population is growing really fast in Papua New Guinea, and people are living upstream and contaminating the water, so people living downstream could not have access to clean drinking water. So with the premium we are using construct water projects, so we could get the pipes to the source up in the mountains and the hills where the water comes out. We block it off there and cement it up and pipe the water so it runs down all the way to the valley, so everyone get the access to the clean water. So that's the need area, yeah.
What sort of geographical area are we talking about? How spread apart are your farmers?
Oh, it's terrainous. It's mountainous, mm-hmm. And people are living, they're scattered up in the mountains, in the valleys, rivers. They're really scattered, yeah.
How long would it take to get from one end to the other?
An hour. It depends. Sometimes, you are talking about mountains. There's two mountains. You can stand on one side and yell to the other side. But if you want to get to the other side, you have to go down, down, down to the river, and then you climb all the way up again. So
it must be hard doing community projects with a community that's spread out.
That's right. Especially, like you want to build a road. Sometimes the government they don't justify the spending on the road. So if everyone can live together and then we put a road through to save, so many people in one project. This one, people are scattered, so we are going to build this road all the way. But what economic returns do we get from spending, public money on this kind of... So they give us very little attention.
Do people live on their farms or in villages and walk to their farms?
They live in the villages, and then the farm would be around them, yeah.
So you've done roading projects?
Correct.
To put roads in that weren't there at all, or to upgrade roads? What's the...
Not necessarily upgrade the road, but just to fix those bad sections where the 4x4 vehicles couldn't get through because of the big mud and all that kind of things. So we engaged the local community, especially the youth group, to come with their spades and all that, to scoop out all the mud and put, stones or cut the timber and make a bridge so we could cross over. So it's not about, you know, upgrading so we could go on third and fourth gears. It's just something, you know, we can go on first gear, but we can transport all our coffee from the farm to the market point.
And schools?
Yeah, we have put some of our premium money into schools as well, into education project. A lot of our elementary, you know, classrooms in the area, they're built up from bush materials, so like thatched roof and bamboo walls and all that. So, like, after some time, it deteriorates, and sometimes, you know, it's a challenge to the parents whether they want to come and build another bush material building that will last for only 3 or 4 years, or we need to build a permanent structure or building that will last for 30 to 40, 50 years, you know. So they've identified the need area, and we have used our fair trade premium money on the education projects too. So we built some, like, 4 elementary classrooms so far, and a teacher's house, all that.
Does the government pay for the teachers themselves?
Yeah, the government pays for the teachers. But again, the teachers, you know, it has to be attractive, the condition, especially the road and the house that they are living in. I mean, they're human beings, and they got options, like whether they want to live in the rural area and work, or they want to live close to the town where there is good road, good health services, big shops and entertainment and all these kind of things. So it's a real challenge for them. So we try to do all this kind of attractive thing, like build a very good house, or they will say, wow, if I'm in town, I'll be renting a little house, and that house will be just small. But if I go and work in the rural area, there's a big, you know, three-bedroom house. I could house my family there, and I can work there. It's a good house. So this some of the things, you know, we do to attract them to come and live and work in our area.
What are the ambitions of the families for their children? What's a good outcome for a family in that area? Is it get them educated and get them a job somewhere else, or are they trying to keep people there? What are people striving for?
They want their kids to get a good education so that they can go and become, you know, ideally like doctors, lawyers, and live in town. So it gives them a sense of, you know, satisfaction that our kids can also compete, you know, at that level, and can be modernized too. You know, we cannot forever be, you know, bushmen, if you would like to say. So, you know, like, yeah, it gives them that opportunity. So they would, most of our parents would like us to get educated and go and work in town. But for those who couldn't make it, and, you know, to big schools like colleges and universities and all that, well, the land is there for them. So they are the pushback, the dropouts. Huh? So the system only gets, you know, whatever it can get, and whatever is left, they return back to the land.
Do you have an ongoing education program for the farmers?
That's right. You know, we have schools, they're registered government schools. And the government pay for the teachers, and the teachers are there, and kids go to school.
That's for the kids. What about the parents? Are you doing? You talked about training programs for the farmers.
Yeah, it's I think training to do with specifically coffee.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but also we are giving them personal viability training, like family business development trainings, and gender equality, you know, trainings. How men and women could appreciate their role and manage their family and their resource, and all this kind of training we are giving them.
So what are the future ambitions for the Highlands Organic Agriculture Cooperative?
We want to grow into a big organization. We want to have, businesses. And we like to get, you know, more interaction with the outside world, like what I'm doing. And get the chance to meet and see, you know, what the importers and the roasters and people like that are doing and what they would require us to do back in our farms that can help them do the sales here. And I think eventually we would like to become the exporter of our own coffee. And there's plenty of work there. We need to build our capacity to that level. But we'll work and find ourselves there in the future.
What messages will you be taking back? What are you going to tell them that you saw or learned?
Oh, I'm going to tell them that I have seen, you know, how people have met and talked to the consumers of our coffee, and everyone that I met said, your coffee is great, it's good coffee. And I was really, you know, really appreciated that. I mean, if they told me something else, that it will be not a good story, but I'm going to tell the guys back in the cooperative, say, guys, I think we are doing at least good job. So our consumers over there are really happy with the kind of quality we are providing. Although we got, you know, issues that we need to address and improve our coffee. Already they are enjoying our coffee, so that's very good. I met the importer and the various different, you know, roasting companies that buy our coffee and roast. And it was a great time, you know, I had. And it's good to see our coffee on the shelf and meet the people, and it gives me a real sense of satisfaction.
Do you think that the quality is the thing that the sells the product, or is it the fair trade badge that's selling it? Do you think is the relationship between those things?
I think it's both. It's that fair trade, you know, logo or badge that's promoting, you know. So when a consumer sees that fair trade, or in buying the fair trade product, we are empowering the rural communities in the developing countries. But when it comes to the market of feed, you know, the importer and the especially the importer and the roasters, they are looking out for quality. And when quality can come with that, you know, message, then there is a market. And it just fits everything together really well.
If you could have brought some of your farmers with you, what message would they be telling? What would they want us to hear?
I mean, like, if I bring some of the farmers, the first thing, you know, like, they will be really amazed with the kind of, you know, place, you know, the cities, the road, and, you know, everything about it. They will be really amazed. Now, it's like from one extreme of life to the other extreme. So they will say, wow, look at this, now how people are organized and how they keep their place clean, and they got flowers and they respect, and, you know, how they live together in a very clean and very, you know, respectful environment. They don't shout and yell and do all sorts of, you know, they mind their own business. That's the first thing that's going to, you know, strike them. Mm-hmm. So this is very interesting. And then, like, later to meet the farmers, the consumers, and then hear about, you know, how they enjoy their coffee. It reminds them of the kind of work they are doing over there and how it has been appreciated by the consumer on this side. So it connects these two, you know, and it gives them a sense of, you know, great satisfaction.
Do you think that the price that you're getting is truly fair?
The price?
Yeah.
Well, I think it's determined by the global, you know, market forces of coffee. So we think we are getting fair price because we see the contracts, you know, and how it has been calculated to, like, this is the New York City market price. And then on top of that, you know, we are doing organic, so this is your organic premium and then your fair trade premium. So we take away the fair trade premium and the organic and the New York City price. So, and then from there we work out and what the exporter gets, what we get. So I think it's fair in a sense. It's fair because after all, we are just working within the frameworks of the global market system.
Do you think that if people from New Zealand, Australia were to visit, they would be pleased with what they saw in terms of the fair trade operation of your agricultural system?
I think very much so. They really appreciate that. No one that went to our cooperative, you know, didn't appreciate. They were really moved. Like we had the U.S. you know buyer come in some time back, and he saw the amount of work we were doing to get the coffee to the market point and to the exporter. And he said, "I can't see any logistics in here. I can't understand, you know, from where I come from, that you have a system that you can move the coffee. I can't really see it." He said, "But how does coffee get to me? It gets to me, and I really appreciate that." He said, "I was just, drinking your coffee for granted, and now I can see the amount of work you are putting, you know, and then like from where I come from an advanced level." I can't really see the operation or the logistics that you have to bring the coffee to me. And then he really appreciated that and then offered that he wanted to buy me, you know, ticket to go to US. So, you know, this is how people are moved when they come. And like, you know, Coca-Cola from New Zealand was up there and he was like telling us the other day, "I went to your cooperative and on my way I was thinking like, am I making the right decision to go there? Is it worthwhile?" But when he got there, he could see the impact, you know, fair trade was having in the local community. And he was really moved. And now he has bought us a small, you know, roaster, a small present. I'm taking it away. It's coming up this year. So you can see, you know, when people go and see the what fair trade is doing in the local communities, how it's impacting the life of the people, they want to get involved. They want to be there. They want to really, you know, go down and be part of the community.
Do you think that we should be doing more, even more, to connect the consumers to the producers? You know, it's got the Fair Trade logo, but could we do more to build that story?
Yeah, I mean, like, I'm here telling the story, but if you go and, you know, like, see it for yourself, you will see it and appreciate it from, you know, different angles, from different perspectives. You know.
Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
Activist? I see myself as someone who is very strong in, you know, trying to bring development to our community and try to do it properly so that everyone is happy and then we see change in our community. I could consider myself as an agent for change in the community.
What motivates you? What gets you out of bed in the morning?
Out in the bed?
Yeah, what do you get up and think, right, today this is why I'm doing this work?
Yeah, I mean, like, when I wake up early in the morning, I think about, all right, let's move the coffee. Let's help the farmers. Let's help them so that they can sell their coffee on time and get a good price. Because after the season, you know, the coffee price drops. While it is high, I have to organize the transport and all that, and we get the coffee quickly to the market so money can go to the farmers. Or we need to get the, you know, crop, the coffee, while it is fresh, onto the other side of the country, to the importers, to the buyers, so they can have, you know, something fresh. So when I wake up, that's the challenge. The challenge for me is getting the money quickly to the farmer and then getting the coffee out while it is fresh to the buyer and the consumers.
What challenges do you have over the next couple of years, on a sort of longer time frame? You talked about developing your own export system. Is that the big challenge for you?
That's a big challenge for me. But to do such a thing, you know, I have to know how to grade the coffee, cup the coffee, and all that skills. I don't have it. I think with the little roaster Coca-Cola Coffee has bought and given to us, I think it will start the process and get us to that to that level.
Do you drink coffee?
Yes, I do, but I drink Nescafe coffee. But not my own coffee, because I don't have the roaster. So whatever is available, I take that.
If you could have a miracle occur, something that's going to make an enormous difference, what would it be?
In my area?
Yeah.
If the road system can be really upgraded, we can work day and night and get, you know, coffee out, get supplies in, materials in, and we can build our community. I strongly, you know, believe in good road infrastructure, because then we can have, you know, health services, education services going. We will have patrol from the police. They can go in and out of the area. They can have, you know, law and order controlled, everything. So I think, for me, if miracle is going to happen in my area, my place, it's got to be road. If we can get a good road system in place, everything will work. Because our people are hardworking people. They are enthusiastic, you know, like they are. You give them a chance and they'll do it. They are not lazy. They don't sit around. You know, they work in the garden for survival, and work is something that's part of their life.
And that miracle is something you're actively working on, with putting some of that premium money into roading.
That's right. We have put part of the premium money to the road. That's where we are able to transport coffee to the market point and then get the premium. So you see there is this empowerment in there. There is no road. Good road, we cannot transport coffee. So there is road, so we are able to transport coffee and also give a good price to our farmers. If the road was really bad, someone would come and offer whatever price they want to. It's really bad now. They can offer whatever price. But the empowerment is coming from that fair trade premium we are using to, you know, bed spots, so we can use the cooperative vehicle to move the coffee and still give the good price to them. If the fair trade premium was not there, we wouldn't have fixed those roads. And the cooperative vehicle wouldn't have come down to collect all the coffee. So someone would come and say, all right, the road is bad, so this is how much I think you should get. And it will be relatively low.
And lastly, do you have any advice for our listeners?
I don't have any advice to give them, but I think I will take this opportunity to thank everyone, those good consumers who have been buying our fair trade, you know, coffee. And while I say, you know, fair trade coffee, I would also like to say, you know, like for cocoa and banana and products like that, you have been so wonderful. Like, I came to Wellington, and Wellington says they are the city of fair trade. I came down to Dunedin, and they also said the city of fair trade. You know, this kind of thing, you know, when we hear, it's really empowering us, and you guys are doing a great, you know, work trying to support us, and I'm really grateful, and thank you very much, everyone, for taking, you know, fair trade and trying to help us have some, you know, hope and meaning and purpose in life in the struggling, you know, rural outbacks.
Thank you very much. It's an inspiring story. You've been listening to Sustainable Lands Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher and me, Samuel Mann. We're broadcast on Otago Access Radio, oar.org.nz, and podcast on sustainablelens.org. On sustainablelens.org, we're building up a searchable archive of conversations with people from many different fields who are applying their skills to a sustainable future. In our conversations, we try to find out what motivates them and what it means to see the world through a sustainable perspective, through their sustainable lens. Tonight's sustainable lens was that of Daniel Kinner, who is the chairman of the Highlands Organic Agriculture Cooperative in Papua New Guinea. He's been here touring the country as part of the Fair Trade Fortnight. You can follow the links on sustainablelens.org to find us on Facebook to keep in touch, and you can listen to Sustainable Lens via iTunes as well. That was Sustainable Lens. I'm Samuel Mann. I hope you enjoyed the show.
This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.